This is a 3CR podcast.
And this is Published or Not.
Good morning, Jan. How are you?
Lisa, what a delight to have you over there panelling today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
And what a delight we have authors.
We do. We have some very exciting people in today. My guest is the award-winning author, editor and podcast host from Secrets of the Green Room, that is, Irma Gold. She will be talking today about her latest book, Shift. Welcome, Irma.
Thanks for having me.
Shift is a contemporary novel that follows Ali, a struggling Melbourne-based photographer who travels to South Africa to uncover the truth about his mother's past and find inspiration for his art. I found this very moving and also immersive. In the township, let me just fill our listeners into a little bit into the setting. In the township of Cliptown, he becomes immersed in a vibrant yet impoverished community, forming deep connections while confronting harsh realities of inequity, violence, and systematic neglect. As he navigates complicated family relationships, especially with his father, and he experiences love and loss and tragedy, his journey becomes both personal and an exploration of whether art can reveal truth and create meaningful change. So my question is, how do you approach writing such a multi-layered narrative?
Oh, gosh, that's a small question to start, Lisa. Actually, I found this a really challenging book to write. My first book, The Breaking, just kind of flowed out of me. And this book I found really hard. And I didn't write it chronologically the way I did The Breaking. I kind of jumped all over the place in writing it. I suppose, in a way, I've been researching this book my whole life. I've always been obsessed with South Africa. My dad was born in Johannesburg to French and English parents and left there when he was in his late teens. And I grew up reading everything I could lay my hands on. At the age of 14, I read Steve Biko, the book Biko, about Steve Biko by Donald Woods. And from then on, I just read obsessively about the freedom fighters. But I didn't get to South Africa until I was in my 40s. But I feel like looking back, I was just kind of researching for this book my whole life, which means you come to it with a depth of understanding, and then obviously spending time in Cliptown itself and getting to know the people there and what the life is like there enabled me to write this book and inhabit these characters.
Yeah, well, it's really obvious. I mean, you know, the sense that you've been there, it really comes across, because I was about to ask you, how long did you spend there in order to research this book? I haven't been to South Africa, but the descriptions of Cliptown are so vivid, and you really capture both the sense of community and the feeling of entrapment and poverty. And I think that must have taken quite a lot of first-hand research.
I'm glad that came through, yes. So I spent a lot of time in Cliptown, and I worked with a youth organisation there called Sky. And Cliptown is like, just to paint a little bit of a picture, you could film a movie set during apartheid times in Cliptown, and all you would need to do is remove the portaloos off the street. So there's no electricity, there's no sewerage system, there's no school, so the kids have to walk a very long way to get to school. There is 70% unemployment, though that's estimated to be actually in reality much higher. And you know, there's just extreme poverty. People live in shacks built from found materials. I went on one trip with one of my brothers who's an architect, and he was saying there's asbestos everywhere. So, you know, it's a place, and ironically, it's the place where the Freedom Charter was signed, setting out the principles for a free South Africa. So the disparity between those two things is huge.
Yeah, absolutely. There are so many contradictions within the place, but also in the dilemmas of the characters as well. And I think that the setting really reflects the, you know, the dichotomy that the character Ali definitely faces. He's drawn toward understanding people in less fortunate circumstances and discovers his own limitation in creating change. That's one of the dichotomies that he faces, essentially because he's an outsider. Let's begin with what Ali ultimately is searching for when he journeys to South Africa.
Well, at the time he leaves to go to South Africa, he is struggling a lot in his personal life. So he's a portrait photographer and he's making works of art, but he's very much in that kind of middle place in his career where he's reasonably successful, but he hasn't made the big time by any means. And so he's struggling in Western terms financially. He's had a string of failed relationships and he's in his early 30s. So around him, people are starting to get married and acquire mortgages and poodles and
yeah.
And he goes through a breakup and it's the catalyst for him deciding to go to South Africa, which is shrouded in mystery because his mum grew up there and just doesn't want to talk about it. So he finds himself in South Africa at a bit of a loss, really, and in a way finds a place in Kliptown, in Soweto, that he didn't when he was living in Melbourne. But at the same time, as you say, there's this contradiction because he's very aware of the fact that he is an outsider in this community and no matter how hard he tries to be a part of it, he will always be an outsider.
Yeah. And it's very sad, isn't it, that he can't sort of affect change in this way necessarily, and we kind of feel, I'm just hoping that I wasn't giving away a spoiler there, I'm just, you know, trying to catch my words before they come out. Let's talk about Ali himself. He's a complicated character. He has flaws, and while he wants to improve the world through confronting reality, he can also be quite judgmental of those closest to him. These contradictions feel very real. Can you talk about how you developed his character?
Yeah, so Ali's father comes over to South Africa to try and bring him back to Melbourne, basically, and Ali resists that. He's very critical of his father and he feels let down by his father. Ali also has a brother, Griff, who is younger and is essentially ticking all the boxes. You know, he's a lawyer, he's got a beautiful fiancée, Jigs, and, you know, runs marathons and is just doing all the things. And Ali feels in his father's eyes that he never quite measures up. So I wanted to really explore the relationship between the two of them. And you're right, it's very complex. And a lot of reviewers have commented on this and seen, I guess, their own relationships in this pair. And there's a generational thing there too in terms of communication and disconnect. And, you know, when one reaches out, the other doesn't quite meet them there. And so there's a lot of pain and anguish in this relationship that they share.
Yeah, you've captured that sort of masculine relationship between father and son in a way that is accurate and exposes all of their sort of self-imposed but cultural imposed restrictions. And we can still feel them trying to reach towards each other. So I really enjoyed that. I also enjoyed, the character of Glory, who is Ali's girlfriend or sort of love interest. And this is she's particularly compelling. There's a sense that her fate feels almost sealed from the beginning. Her hope for their relationship seems to create an anxiety within her, leading to end things prematurely despite Ali's love. And you capture this tension and pessimism that she has ingrained in her so well. How did you arrive at her character?
Well, I think, you know, she's influenced by a lot of people who I spoke to when I was there. But I mean, I love Glory. And with a lot of characters, you can't pinpoint where they come from. But with her, I know where she came from. So there was this one day where my brother and I were invited to go along to the rehearsal of the local youth gospel choir. And I love gospel. I used to sing in a gospel choir myself. And so we went into the gospel choir master's home, and his home was a shack, no bigger than a single room in an Australian house. So the couch was pushed up against the wall and we were all literally shoulder to shoulder with each other. And it's the most powerful musical experience I've ever had. Like the music was just kind of thrumming through your body. And there was this one young girl, probably in her early 20s, who looked so cool.
Yeah.
And she was one of the soloists and she was unbelievable. She was like a Beyoncé in Kliptown.
Yeah.
And it got me thinking, what would it be like to be someone who was that talented, that gorgeous, who in any other context could be a superstar, but here you are in Cliptown, constrained by the world that you're living in. And so I never saw that girl again. I don't know what her name was, but she was the inspiration for the character of Glory.
It seems appropriate now, maybe if you wouldn't mind reading a small paragraph that is about this character, Glory. And I think he's just seen her perform or something, and he's commenting on her performance initially, I think. Is that correct?
Yeah, they've performed on stage and she's been amazing, but something has happened back in Cliptown with her younger brother who she's responsible for, and they're having to make a dash back to Cliptown instead of staying on to finish this trip. So this is Glory talking to Ali. "Freedom is just a word," Glory said, turning to him, her face suddenly animated. "In Soweto, we are still slaves. We've been told for years that we're no good. We cannot suddenly be free. Slaves one day, free the next. There is still economic apartheid, and there is still apartheid of the mind." She tapped her forehead with one orange nail. "You can try to escape, but you will not. In any case, there will always be someone waiting to cut you with a jam tin and remind you where you belong."
Heartbreaking.
Yeah.
So your work explores themes of identity, connection, belonging, and of course freedom. Did your concept of freedom change for you as you wrote this?
Oh, that's an interesting question, because I feel like whenever I'm writing, there is a question that I have for myself that I'm setting out to answer in some way. And I don't feel like you ever necessarily do answer it, but you get a more complex understanding of whatever it is that you're drawn to explore. I think one of the things that I became very aware of, well, I mean, I was already aware of it, but you become almost viscerally aware of it when you're spending time there, is how, and I fed this into the character, you know, in Western terms, Ali is a struggling artist. You know, we would say, gee, he's really kind of living in a way that's, you know, he doesn't have much money. He's not able to do much. But in Cliptown terms, he's extremely privileged. And he knows that at any moment he could phone up his brother Griff and get some money to help him out. So he has the privilege of the freedom to leave Cliptown at any time. And Glory points this out to him. You know, she says, you can leave. And he might feel embarrassed to ask his brother for money, but he can. She has no means by which to leave. She doesn't have the freedom to do that. She has never even seen the beach before in her life. So Ali has this great privilege and this great freedom that I think, you know, here in Australia we often take for granted. So, I mean, I definitely reflected on that a lot. And you can end up feeling a lot of guilt about that. You know, I've got a dear friend, Amin Kalani, who lives in Cliptown, who, you know, read the book for me as well. And I often think to myself, you know, by virtue of birth, she is there and I'm here.
Mm. Yeah, we're incredibly lucky here in Australia. That's definitely comes across after having read that as well. And we are out of time, incredibly. I feel like we've only just embarked. But thank you so much, Irma Gold, for being my guest today.
Thank you.
The book is called Shift, and it's Midnight Sun Publisher. Yes, thank you so much for being
Thanks,
my guest.
Thanks, Lisa.
Well, I've got characters that jump off the page too. Some books have them, and they're more than just words on a page. This is what Sarah Walker has given us in her book, The Water Takes. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you so much.
There are only really three characters in your book, and you kill one off in the first four pages. Tell us about Thomas.
Thomas is the husband of Pam, who is the lead character in the novel. When we meet her, she's in her mid-70s. But the very first thing that happens in the book is a flashback to the moment of his death. So really just driving the knife in the first couple of pages. But then it gets quite funny after that.
Well, Pam is now alone. Mm-hmm. And there's a wonderful encounter with another recently widowed woman, Sharon. Why does Sharon start a conversation with Pam?
Sharon has been going to some group therapy to help her deal with the loss of her husband, and they've given all of the participants this quest that they have to achieve before they come back to the next session, which is that they have to strike up a cheery conversation with a stranger, much to Pam's horror.
Horror. And even Pam, we get her thoughts. Be good. Ask about the deceased. So Sharon actually does. And it turns out that she didn't have a very nice husband at all.
No.
He was a bully and called her a bitch all the time. And yeah. So Pam knows she should say something like, you know, thank you for your honesty and offer some wisdom. But instead she comments on a baby.
Yeah, so Pam is not very good at managing emotional situations, partly because she's never had that modelled for her, and she's a big suppressor of experience and tends to dissociate rather than deal with things. She kind of bonds with Sharon by inviting her to cast judgment on the people that they see at the park, and they have this kind of wicked afternoon of kind of joyous cruelty.
Comments. You know, that's the ugliest baby I've ever seen. And that dog. Oh, look, it is so funny. Pam is observant, but very opinionated. And we've got a little bit about what she thinks about this waitress. She goes out for a coffee and she notices this waitress.
I watched the waitress sail around, her easy stride, the way she cocked her hip to the right while she was taking notes on her pad. She had a tinkling gold cross on a chain around her neck. Her collarbones protruded so much that the chain sank in the dips they created, hard gullies of shadow. I wondered if she prayed nightly to remain that small, that tidy. I was torn between jealousy and pity.
Pam really stands out. She goes to the chemist to buy glasses, and she's absolutely disgusted that she's given a pamphlet for people like her that are so unremarkable that they have pamphlets already printed for them, you know. And in a pub she's never been to, so nobody could recognise her or ask her about Thomas. She's, and this is a quote, she looks like every other half-invisible post-menopausal woman, losing colour and lustre, turning fat and old. Her next-door neighbours, Tim and Camille, they think Pam must be lonely. Mm-hmm. So a visit and then a request for her to look after their 10-year-old daughter, Charlotte. Babysitting does not come naturally to Pam.
No, it doesn't. I was interested in writing an older female character who was not stuck in the stereotypes of grandmotherhood, which I feel like is a mode that I've encountered a lot for older women in literature. And so, yeah, Pam is not naturally maternal. She doesn't particularly know how to care for others. She's kind of so caught up with trying to care for herself that this kind of cracking open of her carapace is very confusing and very estranging for her.
Another quote, I feel nervous around her. This is Pam talking about Charlotte. Worried I'll break her or do something strange that she'll remember and tell a psychologist about in decades' time. So what do they do together?
Pam and Charlotte initially bond over this kind of very tiny love of gardening. Charlotte has seen Pam watering the plants, and they kind of haphazardly start trying to grow this pumpkin vine together. And then there's a lot of Pam just having no idea what to do with Absolutely. Children. You can't play cards with them. They probably shouldn't be gambling. What can she eat? Pam doesn't really remember her own childhood very well. And so she sort of struggles to calibrate her setting for a young child.
But another quote from the book, after Charlotte's visit, the house seemed bigger, like someone had let air in. And when Charlotte sleeps on the sofa, the calm of being awake in a room with someone sleeping, I'd forgotten that calm, honey thick and warm. Very nice, Sarah, very nice. Through the book, we get Pam's backstory of why she's uncomfortable with people. What did she learn about relationships from her mother?
So Pam's father is very aggressive and quite abusive, and Pam's mother models a kind of disappearing for Pam. They both kind of have this dissociative response to trauma in the absence of the ability to do anything about it. And so Pam is kind of struggling throughout her life with this intuition to just go deep into herself until the threat resolves. And part of the kind of narrative of this book is that Charlotte is modelling this very different way of being in public, of dealing with people. Charlotte is so open and collaborative. And part of the question of the book is, in a time of disaster, what do we actually need, and what agency do we allow people?
This could be just a gentle story of a young girl and an old woman learning from each other. But it's cold and it's wet and the water levels are rising, flooding the garden. And then what happens in the supermarket car park?
Sinkholes start opening in the town.
A sinkhole.
Yeah.
They start to appear all over town. The footy oval, so deep, the goalposts disappear. The funeral home, the petrol station, the fire station. Pam remembers a friend talking about Cyclone Tracy and how arbitrary the damage was, where there were two houses obliterated, but the third between them was untouched. How does this affect Charlotte?
I mean, Charlotte's family home goes down, so she's left with Pam as her kind of sole caregiver. And they're both totally bewildered in this situation, trying to navigate what to do. Pam is very interested in sheltering in place. I felt it was very important to me to write a character who couldn't just go on a heroic journey in response to a disaster. I think we often see this kind of masculine, patriarchal hero's journey that happens when things go wrong, where everyone goes, right, we have to leave, we have to go on this quest, we have to learn about ourselves. And Pam is physically not capable of that. She's often in a great deal of pain. She's not physically able to go and be heroic. And then Charlotte is kind of representing this sort of youthful pull to go out to find a better place, to find out what is possible, whereas Pam is trying to kind of narrow the edges of her world in response to everything going wrong. And a lot of the tension in the book comes from that kind of that friction between them.
Lights go out. Power, gas, all gone. No TV, no batteries for radios. The inability for communication, what to do, where to go, what's happening.
Mm.
Who else has survived?
Mm.
Well, as you say, Pam just wants to keep them safe in the house. But on Charlotte's insistence, they walk to the stadium in gumboots. Pam's got blisters and they meet other people. You know, should they be fearful or helpful? When they get to the stadium, there's a great big crack in the middle.
Mm.
Sarah Walker's going to read us a little bit more.
Yeah. On the way out, we could see words. Someone had taken bed sheets and stretched them out between the chairs like a sail, three of them. There was text on them, handwritten, big letters. SOS, said one. The water takes, it's the title of the book, another, and in a different hand, riverbank. When we reached the gate, Charlotte slowed beside me. When I turned, she was frozen mid-step. She was looking over her shoulder at the crack in the grass. She stepped forward, then stopped again. She was up on her tiptoes. What? I asked. She looked back over her shoulder, then back at me. Shoulder, back. Come on, I said. I tugged at her wrist. She stumbled forward, stopped again. Hey, what are you doing? The tension in her was wild. The cords in her neck were pulsing. Pam, she said. Pam, I feel really yuck. Like you're going to be sick? Yes. No. Like I want to go back there. The hairs on the back of my neck prickled. This was new. Her eyes were wide, her breath caught on the intake. I tightened my grip on her arm. What do you mean? I want to go back there a lot. Really bad. Really, really bad. To get the jar of water? No, she flapped her free hand. I don't know. There's nothing there. I know, it's a big feeling, though. I want to go back, but in a bad way. Her eyes on mine. Help. I was stupid, insensate. I don't know what's happening. I don't know what you mean. My fingers clamped on her wrist. I'm scared. I want to go back there so bad, and that's how I know that we shouldn't. I think, Pam, you have to help me not go there. Singing in my ears, heart in my mouth. Okay, I said, oh God, okay, hang on. I touched her free hand. Her wrist stayed completely flexed. Her fingers stayed completely flexed. I grabbed her wrist. I could feel every tendon. She looked at me. The whites of her eyes were threaded with red. Close your eyes, I said, close them tight. Her long eyelashes touching her cheek. Help, she whispered.
Yes. So, Pam gets her back home, but Charlotte wants to get out and she knows that there's the call to the riverbank.
Mm.
And, well, they eventually go there, even with Pam's bruised hip and inability to walk very far. And she gets there and what she finds is a quote from Pam, hippie shit. And there's a woman there who She feels both attracted and repelled. Half of me wanted to sink into her chest and the other wanted to sneer. But these people might be foolish and doomed, but they might not be cruel. Not yet. Not quite desperate enough yet. So they do a celebration of the death, but it's just, what's in this water? Why is it calling Charlotte?
Mm.
And then Pam falls in and Charlotte. Look, it's incredible. No. it could never have been thought of by AI at all, Sarah.
One hopes.
No, we were talking about this before, just AI. No, it is just so there. Look, I've got to ask you, there's a biblical term, the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away.
Mm.
With the water takes, had you ever thought about that?
Yeah, there is a kind of, I've always been very interested in flood mythology and the kind of meaning that we ascribe to water is both a place of nourishment. We talk a lot about being made, you know, comprised of 70% water, and we're gestated in amniotic fluid. It's kind of very deeply part of us. And it becomes kind of a metaphor for caring and mothering and nurturing, but also a metaphor for punishment and for what is deep and dangerous and unknown. And so I'm kind of playing with both of those ideas in the book. I've always been very struck by the quote, the Spirit of God moved over the face of the water, like this kind of like strangeness of water is a representation of what is not known, and the idea that it could contain potentiality of grand things and also terror. And so that is its kind of function as a metaphor for anxiety and fear and things going wrong in the book.
And it certainly does. It does all of those things, Sarah. Sarah Walker's book is The Water Takes. The title is unfinished, just as the ending is open.
Mm.
But the novel has characters so honestly drawn in their reaction to a catastrophe that they will live on beyond the page. Oh, I had no idea where this book was going. Sarah, well done.
Hey, thank you so much. It's very kind.
So, as I say, AI. Now, we started this conversation off air with Irma about being an editor and how you can now look at a manuscript and say, oh, that's AI written. Oof.
Yeah, there's a lot of telltale signs. I mean, the voice is just dead.
Mm.
And it's the same with, there are AI editing tools that you can use, which I would recommend everyone not use, because they do the same thing. They flatten and deaden the voice.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's so reassuring to hear.
Well, it is at the moment.
Yeah.
It's moving so fast. It's such an evolving landscape. And we're certainly seeing, as editors, so many more people are using AI to write books, manuscripts. Mm. It's so disheartening. And I'm, concerned about where it's going.
So I think we all are. That's the thing, isn't it?
There is a very strange thing about, so my first book, The First Time I Thought I Was Dying, was on LibGen, which is the big database used to train AI. Yeah. Do you know if your books have been
had books and short stories
isn't
as well.
Isn't it a strange thing to know that your own work is being used to train the kind of hive mind?
Well, a friend of mine who has published 6 books said that she was working on a book and she put into ChatGPT, write a chapter on this in the style of herself, based on all the books that had been scraped.
Yeah.
And she said it actually wasn't bad. She was like, there were some lines in there that she thought were quite good. There's some that wasn't. But you know, as a writer, you're never going to grow, though. It's based on all of her previous works that have been stolen.
I'm so sorry we can't continue this conversation.
It's
we
very have juicy conversation.
Coming in.
Yeah.
I was speaking with Sarah Walker about her book, The Water Takes.
And I was speaking to Emma Gold about her book, Shift. And it's been such a wonderful chat today.
Fantastic.
Thank you so much, you guys, for coming in.
You've just been listening to Published or Not on 3CR.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.